Hello, listeners. Today is Thursday, February 22nd, 2018. I'm your host, Charlie Mattesian, sitting in for Scott Bland, and you are listening to Politico's Nerdcast. This week, one issue towers over everything else. The gun control debate in the wake of the horrific school shooting in Parkland, Florida last week. We'll call Florida Playbook author and reporter Mark Caputo, and he'll give us some on-the-ground scoop from Florida. Then we'll discuss how the roiling Florida debate is impacting Washington policymaking, both in Congress and in the White House. Finally, we'll close with a discussion on yet another cabinet official whose fate is up in the air. Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin, the last cabinet holdover from the Obama administration, and an official who's battling political subversion within his own agency. Before we get started, a reminder. If you like the show and want to support the Nerdcast, subscribe, rate us, and write a review. This helps us rise in the Apple Podcast charts and allows even more people to discover the Nerdcast. And you know we love hearing from our listeners. We want your feedback and your questions. Email us at nerdcast@politico.com. Let's get started with a call to Mark Caputo in Miami.
Hey, what's up?
I can hear him. First time caller, big fan of yours, Mr. Caputo.
Yeah, it's a big fan club though, man. You gotta call my office.
Let's jump right in on this Florida story. Obviously, this has really captured the attention of the nation, this horrific incident in Florida, and I know you've been following it pretty closely. Can you tell us a little bit about the impact that Marjory Stoneman Douglas students and protesters are having in Tallahassee, but also across the state as a whole?
You know, in about two decades of covering Florida politics, I've never seen a Republican-led legislature actually seriously entertain even the smallest measures of gun control, and they're doing that. So even though it was grim and even though it was terrible, the timing could not have been better because it happened right during the legislative session. And lawmakers are basically trapped in Tallahassee, and you had these incredibly energetic, eloquent, smart, organized, dedicated kids who just led almost like a social media revolution and actually brought their feet to Tallahassee to put extra pressure on lawmakers, and it's paying off. Now, the kids of Marjory Stoneman Douglas High School, they'd like to see an assault weapons ban, that is a ban on high-capacity pistol-grip semi-automatic rifles. You're not going to see that out of this Republican-led legislature, and you're not going to see a bill like that signed by Republican Governor Rick Scott. What you probably are going to see as far as gun control is the regulation of these assault rifles like they regulate handguns, and that's really two things. It's one, actually having a three-day waiting period, which you don't have for the purchases of rifles in Florida generally, and also limiting their sale to people who are 21 and older. If you've been in Tallahassee, if you've lived in Florida, we've got a lot of armed people, and it's a pretty pro-NRA state. That's a pretty major concession that you're seeing by this GOP-led legislature.
Now, I'm sure a lot of our listeners would have watched the CNN town hall last night in Florida on the Marjory Stoneman Douglas shooting. And what really struck me was what happened to Marco Rubio there.
Senator Rubio, can you tell me right now that you will not accept a single donation from the NRA in the future?
That is the wrong way to look. First of all, the answer is people buy into my agenda.
You can say no.
Number second, well.
Senator Rubio really took quite a beating on stage, and I think that was really what a lot of people will remember from that. And there was something of a debate that I noticed at least going on Twitter as this was happening where, you know, some people were saying, hey, at least give Marco Rubio credit for going there. No other Republican had the guts to go there and stand up on stage and try to defend his position. And yet you saw also lots of bile and anger directed toward Rubio saying, you know, he's getting what is coming to him. After all, isn't that his job to stand up before his constituents and take the heat? Can you tell us a little bit about the reaction to the town hall in Florida? I mean, was that as much of a beating on Rubio as it looked?
I think it kind of depends. And you summed it up well the perceptions that Rubio's own supporters, his inner circle of people who are friends and longtime backers, observers of Rubio's, they see Rubio's decision to go there as either completely stupid and foolhardy because he changed no minds and he wound up becoming a little bit of a social media sensation when he got tooled up on by a high school kid over accepting NRA donations and contributions. And then there's the other camp in Rubio world that says, look, you know, Marco stood his ground. He went, he knew he was going to be, in one person's phrasing, attending a public stoning or a scapegoating of a politician, and he took his lumps because he kind of had to. He understood that this was something that he could not avoid. And, you know, if you're going to hold a town hall as a Republican, there's one county you don't want to do it in Florida, and that's Broward County, or as Republicans like to call it, the People's Republic of Broward County. It's incredibly Democratic. It has the highest concentration of Democrats, and then when you factor in independents, it is the most liberal county in the state. If there is one county to go to and to be anti-gun in, it's Broward County. And Marco Rubio is a pro-gun Republican in this anti-gun Democratic county, and it showed.
Well, in any case, it's something we're going to be watching really closely, not just the political response to the shooting, but the debate itself has changed so dramatically, it seems. It feels almost as if we're a tipping point. Mark, thanks so much for taking all this time to walk us through that.
Thanks, Charlie.
Now let's welcome White House reporter Andrew Restuccia. Hey, Andrew.
Hey, thanks for having me.
And we've also got a first-time nerdcaster, Congress reporter and Scoop Machine Rachel Bade. Hey, Rachel.
Hey, glad to be on.
Our first data point today is the number 8. The shooting in Parkland, Florida on Wednesday, February 14th marked the 8th school shooting that has taken place in the United States in 2018. That's 8 school shootings in just 53 days. Rachel, this shooting has brought gun control to the forefront of the national conversation once again. How is Congress reacting?
A lot of what you would expect with both sides sort of further entrenched in their positions, although I would say there are some Republicans who I think are feeling the heat right now and want to do something to say they did something without alienating the NRA at the same time. There was a letter from the Democrats on the House Judiciary Committee that they sent to the chairman just a few hours ago, basically asking Bob Goodlatte, the chairman of the Judiciary Committee, very strong Second Amendment advocate, to have hearings and pass legislation on gun control measures. They specifically were talking about background checks, banning assault weapons, restraining orders for families who are worried about any family members that might have mental health issues and might be unstable and could hurt themselves or others. But the issue here is that Republicans don't see guns as the problem, right? And so the chances of Bob Goodlatte actually having a hearing on this, moving legislation, Republicans passing something like this, is pretty much nil. And I know there's a lot of energy and there's a lot of really passionate young kids who are, you know, on TV right now and talking about this and definitely getting politically active. But changing gun laws in Washington is very hard.
It's really hard in a way that our listeners often struggle with. And when we hear from them, and the way I try to explain it is, I can remember once talking to a pro-gun control state legislator, and I was asking the same question: how could something not be done in the wake of this big public outcry? And I thought the answer was really illuminating. His answer was, the intensity of the support for gun rights far outpaces the intensity of support for gun control, and I wish it were otherwise, but it's not. And I think that's the reality that a lot of these legislators live with. So then, given what you just told us, is there any daylight for any kind of compromise measure?
Mm-hmm. So there's a lot of talk right now about this bipartisan bill in the Senate. The president has said he would support it. It's basically it's a background checks measure that only reinforces existing law. So people are talking about potentially passing that, but Democrats will tell you that this is not really moving the gun control needle at all. It's just reinforcing what is already enacted. And even this is having a problem in the House. I spoke with Jim Jordan two nights ago after the president endorsed this bipartisan bill, and Jim Jordan was saying, I'm not going to vote for something like this. This is a hardcore conservative from the House Freedom Caucus. He says, I'm not going to vote for something like this unless it includes conceal carry reciprocity, which basically allows a person from, say, you know, West Virginia who has a concealed carry permit to walk in or, you know, drive into New York State and continue to conceal their weapon. So it basically creates this national conceal carry license, and Democrats don't want to move in that direction. So it just it complicates everything. Potentially that could pass without conservative support. I do think there are Republicans who would vote for it, both in the Senate, if Speaker Ryan puts it on the floor in the House. But again, this isn't really a gun control bill. It's just reinforcing existing laws and making sure that if certain people are not put on a background checks measure, that there are repercussions for those who were supposed to put them on there.
As you know, CNN had a gripping town hall last night featuring Senator Marco Rubio, Senator Bill Nelson, Congressman Ted Deutch, and that I think had a powerful impact on a lot of viewers. But does even something like that move the dial at all in Congress? I mean, is there any takeaway for members of Congress from an event like that?
I think watching Rubio, and that was actually pretty interesting because he is one of those Republicans who you can see potentially open to doing things like expanding background checks. He said he would be open to increasing the age of the limit or the age limit for a person to buy an assault rifle, right? But then when it came to an actual assault weapons ban, he said, I don't think that that's going to protect anybody because people can get these guns, you know, on the black market or whatever. So I think that there's a conversation going on right now. It's really hard to say how long this is going to last because a lot of times in the wake of these shootings, there's a lot of hype about gun control and it ends up fading. The only way this is actually going to move anywhere is if voters continue to make this an issue and if they actually start taking out Republicans that they don't that don't support gun control measures. Until we actually see someone lose election, I don't think we're going to see many changes.
Andrew, what's the view from the White House? What has President Trump's reaction to the shooting been?
Well, I think for a president who is obsessed with cable news and is very sort of visual in the way that he thinks, this is having an effect on him. He is watching the town hall. He held this meeting at the White House yesterday with parents and family. So, I mean, it's clearly resonating on some level with the president. Now, that doesn't mean that anything's going to change, right, as Rachel was saying. I mean, the president has said a couple things in recent days that are sort of his sort of first initial proposals. He's talked about 21 plus for certain weapons. He's talked about arming teachers, which is obviously a very controversial proposal. He came out today and said that he thinks that there could be bonuses for teachers who are willing to be armed. I mean, it's likely something that's not going to go anywhere. But I think that he's aware of the swell of frustration that he sees. I've talked to a couple of White House people in the last few days. He has been, I think, personally affected because he has his own kid. But I mean, at the end of the day, you know, him being personally affected, him making comments, him tweeting, isn't going to change the narrative that much, unless, like you said, this is a sustained thing that never stops, and he feels that the people who he surrounds himself really believe that. That this needs to change and that there are jobs are on the line.
Well, given the strong relationship he's had with the NRA since the campaign, at least, it seems like he is walking a very fine line. If you parse the language of what he's saying in these meetings, there's an element of apostasy there on guns, but and he could, in a way, have like his own Nixon goes to China moment with the NRA. Is there any reason to think that might actually happen?
Well, there was one interesting thing that he said. I mean, he said in a comment or a tweet that the NRA would back this 21-plus age requirement for certain weapons. Now, that the NRA does not back that.
Right.
you know, so if he's able to convince somehow the NRA to change his position, that would be a sort of – it would be a small moment, but in the grand scheme of things, it would be pretty monumental, right, because it would show that the president has sway with the NRA. Now, we have no indication that it's going to happen, but if anyone can do it, it's a figure like President Trump, who he's able to sort of rally people behind these issues. But it's also politically risky for him, right? I mean, like he has a conservative base that hates the idea of gun control.
Well, he has broken with party orthodoxy on so many issues. Why couldn't he do it on this? Is there any reason to think his base wouldn't let him do it?
I think that it's interesting to see the president. He's saying, like, everything is on the table, right? He's talking about arming teachers. He's talking about background checks. He's talking about mental health. It's like he really wants to change the narrative that, you know, the White House and Republicans in power are doing nothing. But in like a, it will be interesting to see what actually changes in a couple of months, because remember the whole bump stock thing. You know, they talked about getting rid of bump stocks after the shooting in Las Vegas a long time ago. It didn't do anything until the next shooting, and they felt the heat on them, and then they finally acted on that. But I don't know. It'll just be interesting to see which ones are just on the table and are not going to go anywhere. But
right.
You know.
And he does this all the time with every policy issue, yeah. Right? I mean, he throws something out that may be, you know, contrary to Republican orthodoxy, and then conservatives in the House and elsewhere come to him and say, wait a second. And then the next thing you know, he changes his mind. Mm-hmm. So I wouldn't necessarily view his comments today and yesterday as indicative of some major sea change. But who knows, right? I mean, he views himself as a deal maker. You know, he hasn't necessarily shown that as president, but he could surprise us.
Is there any reason to think that he has a deeply held commitment to the Second Amendment that we don't know about? And in other words, you know, when members of Congress talk about it, you know, some of them are sportsmen. Some of them are very committed to the idea of gun ownership rights. And it's more believable. And, you know, I don't mean to be too much of a cynic, but you know, that's not really the life that Donald Trump has led, and it doesn't seem like an issue that he's really been committed to for his entire adult life. I mean, how does he feel about it? Do we know?
I mean, I don't think that Donald Trump at his core is a gun guy, but let's not forget his son, Don Jr., is a gun guy.
Oh, that's
he's
true.
He's a sportsman. Yeah. He's a hunter.
And he's talked to his dad about this stuff.
He talks to his dad about these things. He's been on the phone with him about gun control in general. And if anyone has sway with the president, it's him. So I think he's more likely to be hearing from his son rather than some personal, deeply held commitment to the Second Amendment.
Yeah, when you go on the Hill, like, I have Republican sources who, when I talk to them in the hallway, they will literally pull up their phones and pictures of their latest, like, kill. These are avid, mm-hmm. like, you know, gun owners. The sponsor of the bill that passed the House, the Conceal Carry Reciprocity Act, Richard Hudson, he's been in touch with the White House and Don Jr., I believe, in particular, in trying to say, no, we should be going that way, not gun control. Like, the mm-hmm. gun control that Democrats are pushing is not the way to address this. We need, you know, more concealed carry reciprocity around the country so we can bring our guns everywhere. So it really just shows this is a divide that, you know, emotion is not necessarily going to overcome and change people, I don't think, because they just view the issue of guns so incredibly differently.
And it could be a slightly different story in Florida, right, where you have actual victims of these shootings showing up at the state house in Tallahassee, and it seems like they're not going to go away. So someone like Rubio or perhaps others in Florida might change their mind. But people, you know, in the rest of the country aren't facing these protests, at least mm-hmm. not yet.
Rachel, is there any reason to think, let's imagine an imaginary world where Donald Trump does go out on a limb and press the NRA on a couple of these areas on the margins. Would conservatives on the Hill, is there any reason to think that some of them might go along with him?
It would really depend on what it looked like, I think. But I think the fact that you have conservatives who are already balking at a background check bill that doesn't even change the law and is endorsed by the NRA, a bipartisan bill that will easily pass the Senate, could easily pass the House. I just don't see them supporting anything small, even like raising the age to buy, you know, assault rifles. Or I just, if they are gonna stand their ground on that specifically and not even be willing to increase penalties for not or for breaking current gun laws, then I just don't see them doing that. However, I don't think they need conservatives to do something like this. If the president is gonna back some sort of gun proposal, it'll pass the Senate. It would pass the House with Democratic support as well. All they will need is, like, you know, maybe half the Republican conference or something like that. It could easily pass, but there will always be your hardliners who don't get behind any of that.
Okay, so we're recording this on a Thursday. What does next week look like in terms of this debate? What happens next?
I think we'll hear about it a lot in Congress. Congress has been out this week. So they're out in their districts, they're on recess. They come back on Monday, and I wouldn't be surprised if you see a bunch of members take to the floor and, you know, give very impassioned speeches on both sides of this. you know, the Democrats a couple of a couple of shootings ago. I believe it was after Pulse was when they took the floor of the House and basically held a sit-in demanding changes for gun control changes. I don't know if we'll see the Democrats do that again in the House. We could potentially do that. I think they're going to be under a lot of pressure by the base to do something on gun control. So we could see a standoff like that. I don't think we're going to see many hearings, at least in the House. In the Senate, you might have some more moderate centrist Republicans who are willing to have hearings in the coming weeks and months. But again, I don't expect a huge gun control overhaul to pass anytime soon.
I think what happens next week will totally be dependent on whether or not this conversation lasts another week, right? I mean, it could very well be off of CNN and all the other cable news channels. And I think if that's the case, then you'll see the president and his staff sort of begin to talk about it a lot less.
Well, it'll be interesting to see where members come back on this because they have the most finely attuned political antenna. And after spending some time in their districts, they'll have a much better sense of where their constituents are on this. We'll see what happens in the coming weeks. Thanks so much for joining us today, Rachel.
Absolutely happy to be here.
We're definitely going to ask you back again. And Andrew, you're going to stick around because we have another segment to go.
Great. Thanks.
So let's welcome reporter and editor of Politico's eHealth newsletter, Arthur Allen. Welcome, Arthur.
Hi. How are you?
Doing well. This is your first time on Nerdcast, right?
It is, yeah.
Well, it's great to have you.
But I've been a nerd for years.
So you'll fit right in. It's great to have you, and you couldn't have come at a better time with this story. So our second data point today is one, as in Veterans Affairs Secretary David Shulkin is the only cabinet-level holdover from the Obama administration. Arthur, you wrote a fascinating story this week about what's happening with Shulkin and the Veterans Administration. Can you walk us through some of the intrigue that's happening over there at the VA these days?
Thanks. Well, Shulkin is, he's the only holdover from the Obama administration, and he's been pretty popular at the White House from what we've heard. But this fall, he started getting into hot water with some of the staff over there. The differences have to do with his plans for sort of freeing up veterans to leave the VA to get health care. And there's a question of how much they should be able to decide on their own, I want to go outside. And this affects basically the VA has kind of a bad reputation now, and if you let everybody leave for everything, it's going to sort of gut the organization. It's a fine line to walk. And there was a bill that he supported that has bipartisan support in the Senate that the White House didn't like. A lot of back and forth over that. And apparently that sort of created this bad some bad blood between him and some of the politicals on his staff and the politicals at the White House who were worried about or interested in veteran stuff. So then this scandal, you know, came up, which has to do with it was an IG report over a trip that he took this summer to Denmark and England, in which he spent a lot of time sightseeing. His wife came along. There was a business purpose for it, but the IG report found a bunch of kind of distasteful things, including the fact that Shulkin's chief of staff seemed to have doctored an email to make it look like he was going to get an award there. And because he was getting an award there under these arcane rules, the VA would have allowed his wife to come and paid for her trip. Pretty typical sort of travel scandal for the White House these days, I would say. And Shulkin immediately paid the money back for the tickets, and the airfare said he'd known nothing about it, said he'd, you know, cleared it through the ethics people. Of course, some people continue to want him to leave. And now one thing that's that he did that may have sort of dug it the ditch a little deeper for him was that he put a sort of an exculpatory letter that attacked the IG report on the VA website. And it was later taken down and replaced with a statement from Kurt Kasher, who's ostensibly his spokesman, that said, you know, that the White House takes accountability very seriously and sort of left open the, you know, the possibility that something further was going to happen.
Let me get this straight then. So he gets in trouble with the Inspector General's office on this ethics issue, and all of a sudden the knives come out and his staff throws him under the bus?
Well, yeah. Although the extent to which it's his staff and it's people at the White House who are tied in with his staff.
But I thought he had some sort of friendly relationship with the president. He was one of the president's favorite members of the cabinet. And isn't it a kind of an ideological non-ideological position, or at least his cabinet?
Well, I mean, you know, it's a largely non-ideological position. I mean, this bill that he supported and was trying to get the White House to back was supported 14-1 in the Senate. And it's like this crucial bill that deals with how much money is going to be spent to care for vets outside of the VA. But it's sort of a compromise because it doesn't give the vets total right to sort of go out and get care wherever they want. But it, you know, it was totally bipartisan except for one guy on the committee, Jerry Moran of Kansas, and it was his bill that the White House supports. Does Trump support it? Who knows? Does Trump even know about it? But some of these people at the White House who are paying attention to VA affairs and some of their allies in the VA who are politicals, you know, weren't happy with this direction. And apparently that's the person at the – one of Shulkin's aides who was supporting it very strongly was this guy Tom Bowman. They are trying to get rid of him because he's stood firm on this, that he wants it to be a bipartisan bill.
Well, what struck me about your story was – what jumped off the page to me was the idea that the secretary himself was talking about subversion within his own agency against him. How unusual is that? That strikes me as pretty unusual.
I mean, I've been watching Babylon Berlin, you know, which talks about like the subversion by the leadership of the Reichswehr against the Weimar Republic, and you know, it was a little reminiscent of that. but you know, for him to come out directly and use the word subversion, which he did a couple of times when I spoke with him. You know, tells you that it's a pretty unusual situation.
Andrew, you're in the White House all the time, and you know this much better than I do. But it strikes me that there is an inordinate number of problems with agency heads and the White House. There is infighting constantly, turnover constantly. How commonplace is this?
Well, I think you've seen a similar sort of issue with taking either private planes or first class planes with a number of cabinet secretaries. Obviously, Tom Price, the HHS secretary, was brought down over this issue by some great reporting by our Politico colleagues. Scott Pruitt is now sort of embroiled in his own mini scandal about flying first class all over the country. So the White House is very aware of this issue. They're very sensitive to it at the moment. But in the case of Shulkin, I think that they are sort of waiting, at least at the highest levels of the White House, they're sort of sitting back and they're saying, okay, is this going to become a scandal that overtakes the rest of our agenda? Is this going to be something that is front page news consistently? And with this White House, they really only react when that's the case. Mm-hmm. They only react harshly when they feel like Trump himself is being overshadowed in some capacity. So there is certainly frustration at the lower levels of the White House and the people who are involved in day-to-day VA matters. And this is it's sort of a proxy fight that's been going on for months and months about the future of the VA and, you know, who's the most conservative and who is Shulkin really. Mm-hmm. But right. I think this is going to certainly color Trump's personal relationship with Shulkin. I mean, you referenced earlier that they had a very good, friendly relationship at the beginning of this. But I think it's sort of a to be determined right now exactly what Shulkin's future is.
So it's fair to say it's more than about the optics of the travel?
Up until the scandal hit, people have been very happy with him pretty much on both sides of the aisle. And he's really got this very strong reform agenda. And do you want to rock that and, you know, who's going to replace him? How easy would it be to replace him with one of the ideological people who are supported by Concerned Veterans of America, who really, you know, are kind of out there in relation even to sort of the moderate Republicans on these committees? And I don't think they necessarily would go for that. So my gut is that, you know, they would like to keep him if they can.
And I think that this White House is very, just in general, is very conscious of news cycles and how quickly they move. They were shocked by how long the Rob Porter scandal lasted. And they're aware that, you know, the school shooting whatever it is, I mean, is going to overtake any sort of discussion about this issue pretty quickly. And I'm sure that they have their fingers crossed that this will all just sort of go away.
Right. Well,
is there more sensitivity to this matter because veterans' issues are so central to Trump's core message? He's talked – it's one of the few things he's really seemed engaged in, you know, mm-hmm. as a substantive issue. Maybe he's not in command of the data or the real issues that are affecting the department, but it's something he has talked about consistently. Does that make it a more sensitive issue for him?
I think that will be the sort of last straw for the White House. If this story turns into a where is Trump, why doesn't he care about what's happening at the mm-hmm. VA, which I mm-hmm. don't think – I mean, correct me if I'm wrong. I don't think it quite has got to that point yet.
No, I don't think so, although I do get the sense from sort of Fox and Twitter handling of it that there is kind of this, oh, you know, you've laid off people, you've made accountability, you know, directed at Shulkin, you've made accountability a big issue, and they have like replaced like 1,300 people over the last year there. You know, what about you? You know, spending $120,000, you know, to go visit Wimbledon and, you know, the palaces of Copenhagen. So, but, you know, I that's a drumbeat that you hear, but it's more like, you know, very sort of low, you know, it needs more cowbell before it gets somewhere.
Right. I think. And it doesn't sound like there's a whole lot of cowbell coming out of Congress, right? Other than, say, Senator Moran, who you talked about, right?
And even Moran, interestingly, has been quiet about this because I've been hitting him up, his office, and they're not being aggressive about. There's one congressman, Kaufman from Colorado, who called for Shulkin to depart. He's the only one that was like right as it was kind of coming out. Since then, there's been bupkis and the committee, the four corners or whatever, the Democrat leading Democrats and Republicans on both committees in Congress, sort of voice support for him and, you know, said, oh, they're concerned about accountability. I mean, it's hard to tell. You know, there's going to be more investigation. There's going to be more talk about it. But
well, thank you so much for joining us, Arthur.
Thank you for having me.
Andrew, it's always great to have you.
Yeah, thanks.
And a big thank you to our listeners. Remember to subscribe, rate, and review. And email us at nerdcast@politico.com. Our producers are Bridget Mulcahy and Micaela Rodriguez. Dave Shaw is our executive producer. Our researcher is Zach Montalaro, and our illustrator is Bill Cookman. We'll talk to you next week.